Mother Earth is psychedelic. Her body is covered with psychoactive, sacred medicine. Can psychedelics help us become more conscious and loving parents, partners, lovers, and leaders? Welcome to the Psychedelic Mom Podcast. I'm your host, Michaela Carlin, the Psychedelic Mom, a mother and entrepreneur partnering with Mother Earth's sacred plant medicines to heal, awaken, and learn to live in alignment to my truth. Psychedelic literally means soul revealing. What reveals the soul to oneself is psychedelic. I invite you to join me in deep conversations with leaders, healers, seekers, and other parents. I will share my journey, the wisdom, practices, medicines, and mistakes that have changed my life, and personal stories of others on this wild path. We are the medicine needed to birth the more beautiful world we know is possible. Welcome to today's episode of the Psychedelic Mom Podcast. I'm here today with Peg Peters, and I just finished watching your movie Dosed 2, which was a remarkable story about following a woman in her journey with cancer and the use of psilocybin mushrooms as well as cannabis. So I want to definitely dive into that. And you're a storyteller. You're active in some nonprofits. I know you were a teacher. You're also really interested in the intersection of psychedelics and spirituality. So welcome here today. I'm so happy to have you here. What an incredible movie to watch. And you have so much going on in your life. So anything that I'd missed, I'd love you to share with my audience, you know, a little bit more about who you are.
Well, hey, thanks a lot for having me today. It's really exciting to be with people that really love to have these kinds of deep conversations. And yeah, for me, the world of plant medicine and psychedelics have been a radical shift in my life. And so the journey to get here, you know, I'm 53 now, but the journey to get here has really prepared me to kind of do the kind of work that I really want to do, which is to build resilient communities where these plant medicines can kind of drop into. I'm really interested in not just the psychedelic medicine, like the pill. That's a very kind of very Western framework, like just take this pill and you'll get better, right? Very individualistic. I'm so interested in the renaissance that's happening by building communities around plant medicine, because that's how plant medicine has come to us, is in these indigenous communities that have held these medicines in communal ways for thousands of years. And so, that's kind of my heart passion. But the way I got here is kind of unique.
That makes me even more excited to have you here, because I have the same viewpoint that we're so lucky that psychedelics are reemerging and these earth medicines are reemerging at this time. And at the same time, I'm sure you're feeling the same way. There's benefits to our Western model, but if the Western model superimposes itself on earth medicines and psychedelics as if it's a magic pill or the next SSRI, we're missing the true potentials of these medicines. When you look at your life, do you look at it like, oh, before earth medicines and psychedelics and after earth medicines and psychedelics? You kind of hinted at like dramatically shifted your life. So what is your story a little bit?
I think as human beings, we have these transitional moments, right? I think that's one of the things we're missing, and I'll get into my story, but one of the things that this plant medicine has been teaching us is that these rites of passage in our life, whether that's transitioning from, you know, being a boy to a man, those kinds of, you know, vision quest moments, they're missing in our culture. Those transition times where plant medicines would typically be used, even in ritual ceremonies of moving from, you know, life of working and raising family to eldership, those would be communal ritual moments of altered state work. And so for me, I came to kind of the end of my, you know, I've raised four daughters. My wife and I have been together for 35 plus years. We've raised four really cool girls that are all into plant medicine work, which is a great conversation we should dive into, because—
Amazing.
Yeah, it was my oldest daughter that really got us into mushrooms. She had Crohn's disease, and at a very young age, unbeknownst to us, she had done research on her own and wanted a different relationship with her body and the pain that she'd been experiencing daily from Crohn's. And as a 17-year-old, she read Doors of Perception and did a whole bunch of work with Terence McKenna reading and did her own dosing with guides, unbeknownst to us. And she came out of that experience and said, "Mom and Dad, I got to tell you something that happened to me yesterday." Now, this was 10 years ago, right?
When people weren't talking about it as much.
Right. No one was, you know, we were scared. We weren't into drugs, right? This was a big shift for my wife and I. And yet I couldn't deny the shifts that happened in her, both spiritually and physically. And I knew this was something that we needed to explore. And so my friend, who's a marriage and family therapist, and I, we'd been friends for a long time. We really started to dive in the literature from Johns Hopkins. This is maybe 2015, 2016, and really saw, and what interested me, I mean, he was interested in what was going on in these groups from the perspective of a therapist. I was interested in these mystical experiences that people were having with these end-of-life anxiety studies they were doing. And I'm like, I'm an ordained minister who studied religion my whole life. I've never had that encounter. I've never experienced that. And these people are saying they met the divine. I wanted that.
That's interesting, because my own exploration was the same. I have four children. I was not someone who ever experimented with drugs. You know, we both grew up in the say no to drugs era, and that worked brilliantly. And I had been a meditator and had had mystical experiences in my life. So I started reading about psychedelics when I had a child who had depression. And I was kind of like, ugh, SSRIs, I don't know. But what really pulled me in were these stories about, I think at the time, maybe the movie The Spirit Molecule had just come out too, and this idea that you can actually access the divine beyond yourself and inside yourself. And it's so interesting. My question going in was, I've had these experiences without medicine and with meditation. Can these give me even something beyond that?
That's amazing when you can begin to realize that there are these beautiful substances, these plants. You know, for me, I'm beginning to realize that these plants that have been, we've co-evolved alongside of these. We have certain neural structures that are designed to perfect glove fit. You know, our neuroreceptors fit with these molecules from these ancient plants that are millions of years much older than us. And yet somehow we co-evolved alongside of them for us to have these kind of divine experiences, you know? And so most scholars now are beginning to really pay attention to the understanding that our earliest ancestors, our cave dwelling, our these communities that would have ritual and then paint on the ancient caves, they all were talking, they were all forming pictures of mushrooms and pictures of plants that allowed them to transcend their mind into another realm. And they began to have ceremonies around that. And so this has been part of our human history. Ever since we've been conscious, is we've, as humans, have used altered state work with plants as part of what it means to be human. And it's only really in the war on drugs era that we've really lost, for the last 60 years, that deep connection with plant medicines. And we're wondering, why are we so, you know, so alone, so isolated, where the inundation of mental health issues and challenges on our planet is off the charts? I read a book called Lost Connections. It's an amazing book, Johann Hari. Johann Hari, in this book, he argues that the rise of SSRIs over the last 20, 30 years really parallels this issue of the disconnection that's happening in our culture sociologically. The religious communities that once provided meaning no longer provide meaning. And the fastest growing people now are people that say, "I'm spiritual, but not religious." What does that mean? It means I want to divorce this idea of religion, some kind of human construct that controls my spirituality, and I want to shed that, but I still want to connect with the divine, but I don't know how to do that. So he traces all that loneliness, the fragmentation of families, the idea that we no longer live in the same communities our whole life. We no longer have friends that we can really go deep with. We have people we can talk about hockey with and talk about, you know, raising kids with and all that. But when's the last time you really felt seen in a group, felt safe, felt like you belong, right? this is what's missing. And I'm finding that his analysis is so bang on. And the answer is, I think, staring us right in the face, which is this ability to build resilient communities using plant medicines as a way to come home to ourselves and to home to each other. And so that's what's really kind of driven my life and my work, is how to do that.
It's such a beautiful mission. I can hear the excitement in your voice, you know, and it's true. This lack of connection, you said, when's the last time you were with a group and felt like really, really seen? And that typically is with people that have also done earth medicines and have, because as we talked about, the earth medicine connects us to the divine. It also connects us to our deep kind of shadow and repressed material. As you said, we don't have opportunities to share our grief and our sorrows, so they get shoved down and then we just suppress them. It is interesting to be around a community that has initiations or is in this process of allowing their feelings to emerge, because if you can't do that for yourself, you can't connect with somebody else there. So you were a minister.
Yeah, I love the way you say that. You were a minister. Like, it's got like, how do you make sense of that?
Right. And how did you make the shift? And
it's a beautiful journey. From a young age, as young as, you know, 5 or 6, I really longed for God, whatever that meant. I mean, I was just a child, but I was raised in a Christian home. And so the framework and the language that was given to me was all around Jesus and God. And so I picked that up really quickly and said, okay, this is the language I'm going to use for this longing that I have inside, which is to connect with something larger than myself. I always had that longing. And so I grabbed a hold of Christianity early on as a kid, and then got into, you know, became an ordained minister and went to seminary and got ordained in my 20s. And what really drove me was this idea of being with people in these deep transitional moments in their life, whether they're getting married, working with them, and I felt that was sacred, or whether a person was having a baby, and I'd love to be in those moments of saying, this is a gift from the divine, how do we give back? And that's a transitional moment in a family's life, or whether it was a teenager moving into adulthood and trying to mark that in some ways, or it was death. I loved being around people that were and these end of life moments, or when they felt loss and pain. It was those moments that I felt I could lean into, and I didn't feel scared of those deep places in people's lives. And so as a pastor and a minister, that felt really comfortable, and it became a beautiful place for me to kind of teach and be. But what happened is, you know, in those moments of being a pastor, I mean, my wife and I did feel some deep loss. We experienced 2 losses, a stillborn son and a miscarriage. And it was those communities that really had a tough time sitting in uncomfortable feelings. They wanted to just give a prayer or a Bible verse to make it all go away. But to sit in someone's discomfort is a real deep challenge. And you have to kind of have that depth. And these spiritual and religious communities that I was in just didn't know how to do that and couldn't do it. And we actually found them kind of hurtful and toxic at times. And so for a number of reasons, the definition of the divine kept getting more narrow in these places, and my vision kept getting larger. I wanted to include same-sex marriage was a topic in the 90s in Canada, and I was saying people need to be able to love who they want to love, and God is on board with love. This got me into trouble in the communities I was in. And so we ended up leaving those narrow religious communities, and I ended up founding a spiritual community where I felt, you know, okay, let's found something on our own. And so my friend and I started a church called Nexus, which was an opportunity for people to come to a spiritual community that was rooted in inclusion and love and openness and vulnerability. And so we pastored that for about 14 years and had about 120 people that kind of would weekly come to that. But even in that, even in my time at Nexus, I still felt there was something missing. There was still this deep, like, I didn't understand prayer, for instance. Am I manipulating some divine male God that has to, you know, like, I realized that was baloney, but I didn't know how to think of the divine in any other way than how it has been framed in my life. And it wasn't really until psychedelics.
This is interesting because you were talking earlier about how psychedelics are so good for those important initiations that all cultures have done for thousands of years. We lost that. And you were drawn from a young age to be part of, in your ministry, being in those initiatory moments in life. So I'm really curious, what was the first psychedelic that you did?
My first psychedelic was psilocybin mushrooms, Golden Teacher. And I did about six and a half grams in my very first dose, which was a kind of a crazy experience. But I have ADHD. I've lived in my head my entire life. And the guide that I was working with just said, Peg, we need to get you out of this busy brain of yours. You have a million things going on at all the time. This substance is going to give you a sense of calm and peace inside. And I was like, oh, whatever that would mean, sure. So I did, yeah, 6.5 grams with two therapists present. And that journey was nothing short of absolutely divine. I encountered the divine and I had a mystical experience that was so transformative for me. And it was very feminine. It was very, the mother came and just held me and sang to me. And I remember it because I can feel it again as I touch into it, right? And as we're talking on this podcast, right? And it's like, yeah. You can't unfeel that. You can never unsee that. Once you've experienced it, it's not like, oh, a movie that I saw. It's something deep in your being that you feel that you are connected to the entire universe, that you're connected to the mother, that you matter, that you belong, that you are loved. That all of these other things I worry about are really minuscule in comparison to the fact that I'm good at my being, at my core, that I'm loved. And that's something you can tell someone, but when they get to experience it firsthand, it's what the mystics that I'd read, St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, all of these ancient mystics, Plato, Aristotle, talk about these ideas of knowing yourself and going to the divine mysteries and Eleusis. And finally, I experienced that for me for the first time. All of these ancient scholars and thinkers, I got to experience it for myself, unmediated. Access to the divine inside me, not a male god out there, but a divine within. And it blew me away. And I couldn't believe that this was accessible to me. It changed everything for me. My relationship to my ADHD, I remember for the first time, it felt like there was been 40 voices always talking to me at once in my head. And after that experience, I got out of it. And I said to my therapist, I feel calm inside. It feels quiet. I feel like I've got agency for the first time about what voice I want to listen to. It was unbelievably, just on that level alone, as a person who had suffered with ADHD and still manages it and navigates it. But that was a really big thing, let alone the divine encounter, let alone how it reframed my thinking about my wife and my four daughters, how it elevated their voice in my life. And, you know, I just sat with them after and I just said, your voice is one of the most important voices in my life. And I think I've diminished it. You know, I just sat and kind of held that and realized that as a male, a white male, that the patriarchy had its hold on me. And I mansplained. I butted in. I think I had the best answer to everything. I mean, that was, and all of a sudden, all of that became quiet. And I realized that there were these other voices in my life that I needed to listen to. And these are just some of the kind of unfoldings of what happened, but it was a truly powerful experience for me. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, I can just, you know, in my own cells, feel the deep connection that you had and just the shift in identity, you know, identity to self when you feel you are so deeply loved, but also that you are that love, you know, and then there you are coming back to your daughters and your wife speaking from a place of your essential true nature. That recognizing of like, oh, these other aspects of myself have gotten in the way culture has raised me to be. Like, this is profound change in a journey. What a beautiful, beautiful connection. How did your daughters respond?
It's beautiful. You know, I have these incredible, they're all super strong, independent, powerful women. And so each of them just, you know, affirmed me as their dad and said, Dad, you've always been beautiful. We've always loved you. But yeah, we're excited that you are recognizing that there are other voices that need to be listened to, particularly these feminine voices that have so much to offer you. And I just became this real open sponge for that. And the neuroplasticity of the plant medicine really opens your mind and heart up, right? I mean, this is connection. And I say when we talk in our group work, which we'll get into, that what we're really teaching people as they prepare for these journeys is we're teaching them the language of the mushroom. And it's almost like a language class. And I think people rush into these experiences and they just want to go have a retreat. Ayahuasca retreats, God, let's go do that. The mushroom retreat. And for me, it's like the ancient indigenous cultures and even the Western indigenous cultures, and the Western being ones that have arisen from Greece. And we've got a 2,000-year-old history of our own. I don't have to go to and draw from my indigenous brothers and sisters here in Canada who have their own engagement with plant medicine. I have a European history with plant medicine as it was worked out in the Eleusinian mysteries in Greece. And I got a chance to go there this summer to Greece and to spend 10 hours with an archaeologist on this ancient site outside of Athens, where all of the ancients from Marcus Aurelius to Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Alexander the Great, all of these amazing thinkers would take place in a yearly psychedelic festival where they would drink the kukion, the LSD infused. It was this ergot mushroom that they had developed as a way for them to encounter the divine. And that can radically shift you when you begin to encounter yourself, not unmediated by anybody else, and you encounter you and the divine within you. It can be a completely reorientation toward yourself and to others. And so for me, that was a powerful shift. But my daughters were so affirming about saying, Dad, you're going in the right direction. Pursue this. This work that you want to do by introducing people and educating people around plant medicine, we want you to do that, Dad. We need this. You know, we're in our 20s. And they would say to me, our culture of these young people are dying for some kind of a message like this, of a healing way to connect with yourself and others. And so I'm really excited about building and taking these models, and how do we move beyond just a therapist working with an individual, but how do we bring these into our spiritual communities and use them for spiritual exploration and healing and connection?
I love that. I think that's kind of the next frontier. And I love that you brought up the Eleusinian mysteries, because I'm like, can we just bring those back, please? Can we all work together to create a cultural year where we know this is coming, and we get ready the entire year for this incredible event and share it within community? It was like grandmothers and mothers and fathers, and I think young children as well, experience this. Obviously different than how the Bwiti experience Iboga, but similarly, like, children are involved, every age is involved. And it is interesting to think some of the greatest minds in history have had access to these beautiful plants, and that's what we're trying to bring back. We're trying to bring back, in some ways, it sounds like you're an advocate for the same, to bring back the sovereignty of someone to have their own kind of ability to choose for themselves whether to take a plant medicine or not, and to do it within communities and families, and talking about reorienting an entire society.
The fact that you're even bringing this up, it's so beautiful, because most of the conversation we get is really around, like, clinical trials, and which is important, right? I mean, I'd love to talk about the clinical trial that we just got awarded as part of a partnership using our group model. But you're talking about families. You know, I remember interviewing a gentleman named Dr. Mark Hayden. He's in Vancouver and has been very influential in the psychedelic movement in Canada. And I remember interviewing him a number of years ago for a podcast. And I said, Mark, what does good look like in the future with psychedelics? And I was expecting, like, research this. And he just looked at me and said, what good looks like is mothers doing, you know, MDMA with their 15-year-old daughter, and fathers doing psilocybin with their 19-year-old son out in the woods, and bringing them and having communal rituals where these coming of age ceremonies can happen in family structures and in communities. And my mouth was on the ground. I'm like, you're willing to talk about this publicly? And he said, yes, Peg. tag. Once you get to know these medicines, you realize that they are about community building and healing and depth, and our families need this again. You know, our young people need these rites of passage again, these kind of deep moments of connection with not their buddies. They need to do this with their mothers and fathers and with elders and with, you know, uncles and aunts. This is what we're missing. And we have an opportunity to kind of, in essence, reinvent the way our society is. And I think these plant medicines are calling us to a different way of being in the world with one another.
I think it's interesting too, because what we are going to need, and it sounds like that's what you're working toward, and myself as well, is people that can hold those containers for those that are new. So you've been on this journey and you've learned through the use of earth medicines. They've taught you, you've learned how to maybe integrate them into some of your family ceremonies and at least dialogues. You know, where do we go from there? Like when you say you're really interested in developing communities, what are you doing? Or what is your vision?
So my wife, Heather, and I chatted with her. She's been an elementary school teacher for 27 years, teaching like grade 4 and 5 students. She's also a therapist and a registered clinical counselor. And she's also a doula. And so those three things kind of combined as a teacher, doula, therapist has been a really beautiful kind of mix to bring into plant medicine work. Because when you're sitting with people that are in going into altered states, the closest parallel would be a woman giving birth. And it's like there is a deep, there's a somatic level to it. There's a communal coming around. There's a celebration, but there's a deep hard work. There's a kind of a recognition that there's something divine being birthed within you. And sometimes that's a struggle. And so as a doula, she helps a mother be comfortable with touch, with connection, with encouragement, to be able to remember that this is what your body can do. You're part of thousands and thousands and thousands of years of people doing this exact thing. And that's what we believe with these plant medicines, that when you come into ceremony and you sit in, for us, we have a 12-week protocol, what we call gathering groups. And the gathering group model was first introduced to me by a professor at Vancouver Island University here in Canada named Dr. Shannon Dames. She had developed a 12-week resiliency course for nurses. She was a nursing instructor. And she saw that nurses were going off on long-term stress leave after 5 years of work in the healthcare system. Now, if you think about how much money we've invested in these young people, and they're going off on long-term stress leave because of the toxicity of the culture and the stress of the job, she's like, what can we do to prevent this?
And it's supposed to be our wellness culture, right?
Yes. This is supposed to be people on the front lines helping, you know? So she developed this model that really looks at, it's not therapy, it's a community of practice. And so she developed this very trauma-informed, predictable group that it has the same kind of 5 structures in it. There's a check-in, which gets you in touch with using your breath into your body, getting out of your head, using some breath work. There's a bit of a grounding practice. And then there's one question that you ask each week, and you have a timed 3-minute share. So no one, it's like a talking stick. So a very ancient, indigenously informed kind of framework where you answer deeply emotional question for 3 minutes. You stay in the moment. You speak from their heart. You share with the group. The group is then quiet for a couple of seconds. And then 2 or 3 people respond from an embodied place, not fixing, not therapizing, not even trying to encourage, right? Not even, oh, I feel so bad for you. No, it's like, this is what's coming at my body while you're speaking somatically and emotionally. And what happens is an energetic exchange happens. You begin to feel heard and seen as this goes around the circle week after week, and the vulnerability gets titrated in week after week. And by about week 5, you really feel that this group, when the cameras go on, there's no talking about your children or your marriage or your job or money or sports. The only thing that is allowed in that 90-minute call is the heart-focused connection with one another. And so you feel a real instant depth with these people. And it's based on something called polyvagal theory. Now, Stephen Porges is the founder of this kind of framework. And all it means is that we are social creatures. We're mammals, that we have evolved in group patterns for our nervous systems to co-regulate with other mammals. We cannot co-regulate by looking in a mirror. We can't do that. We're designed as social creatures. You know, we see these early kind of videos of monkeys when they're, deprived of love. They would rather hug a kind of a soft teddy bear monkey than actually have food. And so we know that our primary need is for belonging, not even anything else. And when we can create that sense of belonging in the group first, we do that for 8 weeks. And about week six, we start introduce intention setting for your dosing session. And we begin to create intentions.
I love that you're preparing in such advance. You know, this idea, again, the Western model tends to do 2 prep calls, the journey, 1 integration call after. And this way of presencing, as you said, to sit in space, to feel like someone's not there to fix you, offer you advice, but to just presence with you what's going on in their body. I think the other piece of it that's so powerful is, I don't know if you were like this, but on my kind of quest for psychedelics, I had no idea how disembodied I was. Like, I was kind of in my mind, but I'm also a creative. And someone who liked being in my body. But what I didn't realize is, like, I didn't really know what being in my body was, how to really presence the emotion that was coming up in the moment with somebody. So to do that practice before you even go into a journey is so profound, because that's what's going to come up in the journey, is the sensation in the body.
Oh man, you're nailing it. The way you just reframed that for me is so beautiful, because it's really about presencing. That's a beautiful word. It's about being present with what's coming up in my emotions and my body, and about other people paying attention to what's happening inside of you when you're listening to me. And how can we exchange that and sit with that, right? And so as you do that for 8 weeks, then you're ready and you have this co-regulation that's happened. And so when you get into the medicine space, your 2 facilitators now come to the retreat center with you. You're joined by 2 other space holders, usually a nurse and another therapist. And then we have a safe container that we've co-created with one another. So it happens naturally that your body's going to naturally let go, because you already feel safe with this group. So there's not a guarded, you know, as what Brené Brown calls armoring. The armor has dropped away. And so now you can really get in to this heart space in the medicine experience. So when the medicine comes on, you're in a circle, you're laying down with eye shades and your headphones, but you're in this connected circle with your heads in the middle, and you really feel like this bond with this whole team, and everyone drops into the space together. They all have their own individual intentions, but we also have group intentions. What are the themes that's emerging with us as a unique coming together in this moment? And so the journey happens. We then integrate together for that day. We do some drawing. We eat together. We have a communal meal together, which is really important. And then we have an integration circle to close the day, where we give voice to what are the emotions and sensations that are coming up for me now 2 hours after that, you know, that session. Then we go back online and we now integrate for 4 more weeks with our community. And then that community, it's the 12 weeks is over, but we extend it for another 12 weeks as we've taught this group now on how to do this work together as a peer-led support group. So they stay together, and a therapist just drops in every second week just to check in on them. But we're trying to encourage people to attach with one another and integrate together. You don't need to pay someone $180 an hour to integrate when you've got 8 people that have just journeyed with you for 12 weeks that know you, that value you, that love your voice. And so we keep that going for another 3 months. So we have a 6-month arc, and the transformation that stays, this is where we've been tracking these groups. We've done 25 groups now, over 200 people gone through this protocol. And it's absolutely profound. The longitudinal shifts on depression, anxiety, PTSD, all of these kinds of things begin to diminish, because you really begin to get in touch with who you truly are, and you begin to have that affirmed by other people in a community. This is the way that psychedelics need to come into our world, both for so many reasons. Number one, it's the best way to integrate. It's so much more accessible, and this is how human beings have done it for thousands of years.
I love this. I love the arc that you're talking about. I mean, I have my own experiences of having longer arcs with clients, and it's so profound when someone is willing to take the journey, the wisdom learned. And as you spoke of yours, your mind and heart are blown open and every cell in your body are blown open, to actually then create the change after being so open and altered. Even you spoke of a deeper understanding of your cultural conditioning as a man, right? That's a radical shift. How do we then implement those into our lives? We can't do it with like two integration calls. And I love this idea of the circle and being held in a circle while you're doing the medicine journey. I'm curious, is there from the training, because I think like somatic inquiry, for example, is so important. It's so important to be able to go in and do somatic inquiry and work with people that have maybe some idea of what internal family systems is and all the parts that may arise in a journey and how to integrate those parts. So is that some of the languaging, or is there not some of the languaging, but do you kind of have these tools built in so that everybody's kind of watching and learning how to do this together?
At the start of every session, we have a recorded 3 to 5 minute teaching. It's really short. We want to keep people out of their head, but we have a beautiful indigenous elder, somatic healer that's been working with us to give us some teaching. And so we play some of these recorded teachings, and they're really just tools. They're about skill practice. They're about breath work. They're about somatic connection. They're about emotional intelligence. We use some of Tara Brock's work around radical acceptance and the practice of rain, which is really coming into the present moment, recognizing, allowing, investigating, nurturing the deep emotions that come up. And then we introduce internal family systems, just a little bit of the work from Dick Schwartz, 5 or 6 minute teaching. We don't need a lot. So we just need a little bit. You just understand that the way that you're going to encounter yourself in these altered states is you're going to understand your term in terms of parts of me. There's a part of me that's angry. There's a part of me that was abused. Not all of me. There's not all of me that is lost. And that gives a sense of hope, that there's a deep sense that in my true self, my deep, deep part is unbroken, undamaged, untraumatized. And if we can kind of get back behind some of these parts, there's this beautiful divine essence that's accessible to all of us, you know, beyond all of the trauma. And that to me is such a message of hope. So we definitely introduce internal family systems as another tool to help people make sense of these downloads that they get when they're in these altered states. We sometimes use the metaphor of like a language class, right? So that in the same way that if you were going to, hey, I want to go to Italy and know how to kind of navigate around, well, we take, you know, dual lingual and we're going to learn a bit of Italian, right? But you want to get prepared before you go to your trip. Well, this is language work. We do 8 weeks of language training so you understand the language of the mushroom. We don't speak that in our culture. We speak up here. The language of the mushroom is down here. And so this work gets us into our body, gets us into this deep emotional work here that we're really bracketed away from in our culture. As we teach that in a group setting, you get, you know, it's a factor of 8, right? So there's not just me speaking it with one other person. There's 8 other people learning to speak, and I'm learning from them at the same time. So there's an 8x factor of kind of learning that happens. And so for 8 weeks, we do this heart language training so that when you drop into the mushroom, you begin to understand the downloads that you're getting. They come to us in image and metaphor and heart places. And as you learn that, you're going to go, oh, that's what it's teaching me, right? But you can go into these experiences, have your mind is blasted wide open, and you can't grab a hold of anything. It was just, well, it was really amazing and saw divine and I'm back at work and my workaholism and my stuff. And you're like, we've got to teach you to understand the language that you're going to be downloaded with so that you can integrate that properly.
It's almost like dream work too, right? It's like the language of dreams. It's like, I love waking up and being like, what was that teaching me? Because, you know, there's psychedelics and mushrooms and these journeys. And the way that you guys are doing it, I'm actually so excited about, because I have not heard anybody talk about this model. And I think it's like really like you're really putting the pieces together. And I'm sure it will be something that, just like the mushroom, will grow and adapt. And I love the idea of what you're doing as a community and as a group together and where that's going to go.
You know, as we've kind of been working this group model out, we learned it from this Roots to Thrive model, and then we've adapted. They were using ketamine in the beginning. We've pivoted to using psilocybin. It's a bigger heart medicine, and really, it's more connective, right? It's really a true psychedelic that is, it's a plant medicine that connects us. And so for us, the whole focus is around belonging.
Decomposes the aspects of ourselves that we are, you know, not in need of anymore.
Yeah, and so we've been working this, and then in the last 6 months, we've been working with a number of first responders. And so what we've decided in conjunction with them is we've just put forward a clinical trial that's going to be part, MAPS Canada is sponsoring it, is with us, and Empower Psychedelics, which is these guys from these first responder community. And so I'm working alongside of a physician, my brother, who's a physician, and a psychiatrist, and a number of therapists. And we've just been given an ethics green light from Health Canada to do a clinical trial using this 12-week group model by putting these first responders into these communities of practice and then working with them to prepare, giving them a high-dose psilocybin experience really as a way to deal with their trauma, to deal with their sense of the deep depression that a lot of them face. And it really shows up in this a sense of being so overwhelmed by so much trauma they face that they have to disengage their emotions. They cannot show up. It's just been so overwhelming. So we're going to help them feel again, to allow that trauma to move through their body so they can show up for their wife, their husband, their kids with a heart that's not so jaded and traumatized, but they can actually show up for their life again. And so we're really excited. Hopefully by January 2024, we can launch, it's an N of 36, so they're going to launch six groups of six. We're going to track them and look at the data of how we can shift depression, anxiety within 12 weeks. And so we're really excited to do that kind of clinical work, but it's really based on this model that we've been really working out for the last couple of years. So really excited about that.
Do you use natural mushrooms?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting debate, right? So at gathering groups, we use golden teacher mushrooms. We make a tea. But for the clinical trial, Health Canada is saying we have to use a standardized kind of medicine. And the only place in Canada that's doing that is called Filament Health. They're one of our sponsors. Filament has designed or have found a way to extract the natural psilocybin from the mushroom. It's not synthetic. It's natural. It's just an extraction process. Now, this allows them to get the exact dose that they want and be able to replicate it. So it's a product. Again, it's probably not where I want to land as far as, I want Canadians to have access to mushrooms that they can grow themselves. That should be your fundamental right as a citizen of Canada to be able to consume plants and mushrooms that you grow in your yard. But at this stage, I get it. The medical, establishment is saying if you're going to do a clinical trial, we do not want the variability that may come in from a batch of mushrooms, right? They want not a synthetic, a natural extract. So that's what we're doing for the clinical trial.
So I'm going to be curious. I want you to report back if there were any differences in using the natural mushroom or using the extract. Yeah, that'll be interesting. Because we do have to really look at the way decriminalization and legalization is going. You know, when we really look at the model in the United States, I don't know about Canada, but like MDMA and, the five psychedelics were legalized in Colorado and it's, spreading. But really that legalization is not true legalization when you look at it. It's like, is it legal for me to go to Colorado and do MDMA? No, I have to go through a therapist. I have to go through kind of MAPS. I have to go through, it's so interesting. And I think this is such an important conversation as citizens who truly want sovereignty within earth medicine space. And what you just said, that everybody should have the right to grow, to have these medicines as they wish. We really need to be careful about how what legalization really looks like.
You're bringing up a really beautiful edge that I think is important for us to continue to put on the forefront. I think, what's happening in the Western more medical model is that like organizations like Health Canada, FDA, these other kind of organizations have very rigid ways of working with medicine, right? So even in the clinical trial, we're back and forth with Health Canada. They want to do things like body mass index must be an indicator of whether someone is ready for this work or not. And I went, You have never talked, you've never experienced plant medicine. Psilocybin has nothing to do with your BMI. It doesn't matter. That's not an exclusion criteria. We have to reframe how we even think about clinical trials, right? And that, yeah, so there's a lot of energy that comes up in for me when around this conversation, but I'm like you. I really think that our end goal here is, yes, we want Health Canada to open up and allow physicians and therapists access to these plant medicines to be able to prescribe. That might be step one, but that's not where we're trying to land. What we really want is that this can be an open conversation for people to have as consenting adults, and that they can take them with sovereignty and with safety in community structures that can really help hold them. And I think if we have those available, people will make use of them. You know, we're at this place where we actually want to come back to our provincial governments and say, you should be funding this research. Why are we as citizens having to raise our own funds? It's ludicrous. Universities get funding.
It is crazy.
And yet here we are trying to raise $250,000 from citizens of Canada for this clinical trial to help our first responders. It's absurd. It's wrong. It's unethical. Our province should be funding this. And so I hope I'm trying to get a meeting with the Minister of Mental Health here in British Columbia for us to be able to bring some of our first responders and psychiatrists to say, we have a study. We have a medicine. We want to try this. We know it works. We know it's safe. We've got all the evidence. We just want funding. This is nothing for you to help fund your first responders. So I hope that there's a movement of citizen that come behind this and say, come on, let's give people access to this so they can find some connection and healing. We know it works.
Okay, I want to go two places. I want to find out what you learned from the movie Dosed 2. And also, I want to know first, maybe, have you taken a family journey? And if so, what that was like?
What? Two great conversations. Ooh, I get excited. So Dose 2 is such a beautiful film. And the way that film started is my friend Laurie Brooks, I've known her for 30 years. And sadly, when she got cancer, she got this diagnosis of terminal cancer. And it was just really tragic for our friends. And she was part of our community. And we just sat with her and it's like, oh, Laurie, you have four children. You're this beautiful mother. And here you're giving this sentence that your life is going to be cut short by this disease. And my friend, as a therapist, really reached out to her and said, you know what? Here's the research that's coming at Johns Hopkins. Here's what's coming out of NYU. Are you interested in looking at the end of life anxiety that you're facing? I mean, she's waking up with tears in her eyes, can barely sleep because she's only thinking about the end of her life. That's all that's consuming her, right? Of course. I'm going to miss my daughter's wedding. I'm going to miss this. Would you be willing to do a high dose psilocybin experience to deal with some of that? And she, said, yeah, I think I would. She goes, I've never done any drugs, but I think this looks really, I'd love to explore. And I mean, I'm a filmmaker and a storyteller. So I just said, Laurie, would you trust me to be able to film you before and after and really kind of put a camera on you? And I know it's vulnerable and I know that's really kind of scary, but would you be willing to allow me to document this? And she said, oh, Peg, I totally would if my story can help someone. So I got my camera out and I interviewed Laurie about, what she felt going in and all the fears she had and all of that and her navigating her Christianity and doing psychedelics and what that would be like for her mom who would, be really scared of this. And
I was kind of surprised at that part, actually, where she was like a little nervous to tell her mother, and I don't know why I should be surprised because I was kind of quiet about my own earth medicine psychedelic use and then finally wasn't. It's kind of, there's these moments where it's kind of the coming out of the closet moment of being authentic and true of what's really going on. So I found that interesting in the movie when she was kind of tentative to tell her mother. What a beautiful moment.
So that's how it started. And then after that first initial psychedelic experience, we realized that the radical shift in Laurie was so big that this story was going to be way bigger than just a little 5-minute video that I was going to make for her and her family. That there was a real potential here to track Laurie's progress as she navigated cancer. And so it was right around then that I went to the premiere of a film called Dosed, the very first one, where these two beautiful filmmakers presented this film around a young lady who was trying to, she was an addict on the downtown East Side and was seeking to get free from her addiction and turn towards psychedelics, mushrooms and iboga as a way to really deal with her drug addiction. And I met these guys, Nick and Tyler, after the film. And I said, hey, I'd love to go for coffee with you. I've just started a film, but I think you guys could be really helpful in this journey because you guys have a real heart to do what's called cinema veritas, which is the word true, which means you bring a camera into someone's life. You don't just kind of film them in an interview. You bring a camera into their daily life to pick up those kind of stories. And I knew that's what we really needed with Lori. So they came on board the project and really started to film almost weekly with Lori and her family as she went through cancer treatment and this diagnosis. And really started to look at the impact of psychedelics, not just on the cancer, you know, itself as the molecules of cancer, but actually the impact of your relationship with death and dying and how that radically changed her life as she had a new relationship with death and dying. She had a new openness toward herself, toward life, toward her kids and her marriage. And the film really became a love story.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
And it was really a story about her and her husband and a family that navigating really dark waters. And the story, so I'm really proud of how that film turned out. Lori's still alive 5 years later. And not only that, but she is one of our facilitators in our gathering group. She walks other people through 12-week journeys, and she really invites people, particularly if they are facing cancer. She says, sign up for my group. Let me help you, you know, encounter the part of you that is scared so that you can have a new relationship with yourself like I have. So Lori is just this beautiful light now, helping and healing others as she lives out her, you know, her day.
Actually, you know, it's funny. I have a client that came who has cancer, terminal cancer. And when you guys sent me the movie this morning, I sent it to them and I got to the part of the movie where the cancer has grown a little bit. She's deciding surgery or not. And I was like, oh gosh, I don't even know how this movie ends. I shouldn't have sent that. And I kind of deleted it. And then when I came to the end of the movie, I thought, you know, what a beautiful story because, I mean, again, she is 4 years out of her prognosis of life. Here's a movie about death, another initiation that we don't speak of. I loved in the movie was it Chin? What's his group? What was his tribe or what did he call himself?
Oh, yes, yeah. He's from the Matsqui First Nation here on the land that I live right now. And he really talked about how the indigenous First Nations people of this area have a very different relationship to death and dying and how they work, you know, how they do funerals and where they think about the spirit of the loved one. When someone passes on, spirit is enhanced. And so trees, river, fish, this is where spirit is. And so I think for us in the West, spirit has been bracketed only to some kind of male deity in the sky. And we've lost touch with the divine nature of all of life and how powerful tree is and plant and river and water. And that's all feminine work.
The feminine.
Yes. So that was, I mean, I encourage people, go type in Dosed 2, the number 2. There's two films, but the second one's called Dosed, A Journey of a Lifetime. You can watch it for free or just donation.
I loved how she said, even if her life wasn't extended, what the mushrooms taught her was to live a happy, authentic life. And to live a happy, authentic life that is shorter is better than living a longer life where she hadn't really reached a sense of true authenticity. That was beautiful in that movie.
It's unbelievable. You can't, there's no amount of therapy that can get people to that, you know? How do you tell someone who's dying that there's beauty in life, right? In that, in each moment, you have no right to say it. You just kind of go, who am I to say it? I'm not dying, right? But for a person to encounter that for themselves and to experience that, and then to be able to be turned on to life and to each moment and to be able to live each moment as if it might be their last, is a real message for all of us. You know, Lori's living that way, but it's really a message to every single person that whether you have cancer diagnosis or not, we don't know when our last breath is going to be. And so it becomes an invitation to all of us. And so I would encourage folks, if you want to watch a beautiful film, just go to Dose 2 and do a donation, which just helps the filmmakers. None of it goes to me. It all goes to help promote this film, to get better access to psychedelics, and to help promote this story online. So go check it out, and I would love to get your feedback on that. So I'm really glad that you enjoyed it.
And you had some amazing teachers in it. Gabor Mate's in it, and Paul Samets, and Dennis McKenna.
Yeah, Dennis McKenna is like a neighbor of mine. He just lives a couple kilometers from here in Abbotsford, British Columbia. Just a beautiful friend. And him and his brother has done so much for psychedelics. And particularly, I give a lot of credit to Dennis, particularly for bringing the idea of the spore of the Mexican mushroom back into population. He began to send out seeds when it was criminalized in the 70s. Him and his brother realized that the mushroom wants to spread itself. And they began to get spores and spread them and just send them out to anybody around the world so they could keep it alive, right?
I know. I saw that Dennis McKenna, no, it was Paul Stamets actually, had created these boxes, corrugated boxes. I don't know if you, and in the boxes, you know how they're corrugated? So there's these spaces. There was like a forest of seeds in each one with like the tall, tall trees of where he lives.
He lives up on Cortez Island in British Columbia, and these giant ancient cedars, Douglas fir, these big, big ancient trees that when they fall, it's that bark, it's that decomposed ancient trees that these psilocybin mushrooms want to be in and can kind of spring up. So he has this beautiful area that he is creating a nature reserve there, untouched ancient forest, to allow these psilocybin mushrooms to populate, and he collects and tracks them. And so, Paul is just a beautiful friend, and I love what he's about.
So, family journey. Have you had one?
I'll tell you the most recent one. And one of my daughters is one of our facilitators. She is an RMT. And so my oldest daughter is now one of our group facilitators. She runs groups. And so she brought one of her groups into our space. We have a retreat center. My wife and I have a farm out here in the Fraser Valley where we do some of this kind of work. And it was one of the most magical moments where we were in a circle. My wife is there, myself and my daughter. And we were just holding space for their mushroom experience, dealing with trauma and pain and loss. And one of the women just kind of sat up and said, that she started crying. And she's just like looking at the three of us sitting there holding space for her. And she said, it feels like I'm being kind of refamilied, reparented by, this is what I really wanted a father to feel like. A man like myself, in touch with my emotions now, being able to hold space, my wife, my daughter, all creating this beautiful dynamic for people to transform and heal. I'm just so proud of the work my daughter's doing to help people transform and heal. And to do this work alongside our family, to have them come alongside and support this work. My one daughter's a nurse. I have another daughter who works with animals and plants as a farmer, really connected to the land we're on. My other daughter works with special needs, with people with autism. And so I just got this beautiful, rich array of these beautiful healing women that love this work. They're all healers, and they all have come around us and said, we want to support this work as a family. And so it's been just such a gift for me as a dad to be able to work alongside my family in this work.
So I have one more question. So we started this kind of with the excitement of spirituality and this journey of meeting a different God, divine, sacred presence, whatever anybody calls it. And you came into this as a minister in the Christian faith. What would you say through your journeys, through this work, where you've landed as far as a belief system or a ideology, philosophy around spirituality?
The question is beautiful. And I really love how you gave a whole bunch of different ways to access that, right? So you had words like belief, you know, systems. I think for me, I've really pulled back from framing as belief or dogma. I think the shift we actually need is we need experience. And so what I'm really interested in is a really embodied experience of the divine accessible to anyone. That's kind of what, you know, where I've landed. And so what does that mean? That means that I think these sacred plants, these entheogens, these divine manifestors should be accessible to everyone who wants them. And that when you allow someone to be able to have their own experience of the divine, they get to use the language that makes most sense to them about what that experience was like. Whether you encounter the divine as a feminine deity in the sky, or whether you encounter it as an elephant, or you encounter the divine as the life force energy of Shiva. I don't care. Those are just language. Those are just words that we're placing on an experience that we all have the right to encounter. And for me, the learning that I'm getting from these ancient places like Eleusis outside of Athens, this was the one time in their calendar that slaves, emperors, philosophers, everyone was equal, and everyone came into the temple at Eleusis. The Telesterion was the name, at equal. And there'd be 5,000 people in that sanctuary at once, all journeying for 12 hours on a sacred psychedelic that would take them into the underworld as they celebrated the Persephone Demeter story of a daughter being kidnapped down into Hades for 4 months and being released, going through death and resurrection. That theme of death and resurrection is foundational to my spirituality. And so, and every culture has believed that theme, that what it means for human beings to confront their own mortality is to die before they die. Because if you die before you die, death no longer has sting. The book of Isaiah says, Jesus says, you know, it's when you're, the kingdom of God is not up there in the sky. It's right here within you. Behold, the kingdom of God is right inside of you. It's right present. For I am the vine, he says. I am like this true vine that you can abide and connect in me. And so for me, there's this new way of framing some of the ancient Christian language that I have to be able to make it, not make it, to understand that it is deeply congruent with these plant medicine experiences. And I had a radical shift when I read Brian Mirarescu's book, The Immortality Key. He was a scholar talking about how the ancient Greeks from the Eleusinian Mysteries that I just mentioned, has that lineage came into early Christianity through the Greek-speaking world, and that the early Christians were using a spiked Eucharist, that when they do archaeobotany tests on the ancient vessels underneath Rome, underneath the Vatican, they scrape these ancient chalices that held the sacred wine of the early 200, the first couple hundred years, and what they find is that this wine has been spiked with henbane, with ergot mushroom, that this was a psychedelic Eucharist that the women would be serving in house churches. People were having a direct encounter.
I love that the women were serving it.
Yes, they were.
It was the priestesses that initiated.
Yeah, and this is something you cannot get away from. All of the ancient religions and spiritual traditions that have worked with plant medicines were always held by mothers and grandmothers. And this is important for us to get back to. And so we try to have a grandmother present in all of our ceremonies, one of our therapists, and we try to say, we need this kind of wisdom, people that have lived life and felt pain and know what it's like to be a mother and hold all of the pain of their children and their children's children. We need that energy in the room. So yeah, for me, it's about an experience.
Totally. It's like Mother Earth, right? She holds it all.
Yeah, it's about a divine experience for people. That's what I really want to advocate for people.
And learning how to, beyond medicine, live it in the daily life, the presence within self, being in reality of this reality, in our senses, in the sounds, in the smells, in the sensations in our bodies. That's why I think our bodies coming back online from psychedelics is so important, because I don't think unless we access our bodies, we can really be present to how it's always right here. Because if we're up here, we're missing that it's actually right in front of us in everything. It's been so nice to talk to you.
I get so excited when I'm speaking with people that are tracking with the same kind of way of seeing the world. And so this just feels like I'm with a friend that really gets this. And it's been beautiful. And yeah,
exactly.
So thank you for your interest in our group process. We have, we always have groups. If people are interested, they can go to gatheringgroups.ca. You can take this anywhere in the world as long as you can get yourself to Vancouver for the retreat. But it's all online. We prep everything online. We integrate online and you just come in person for the ceremony. And so it's wide open to whoever. And we have groups forming and starting in the next 6 weeks. So I don't know when this launches, but really happy for your interest in this model. We're really hoping that people listen to it.
Yeah, I love this model. I will put the details for your next retreat in the show notes if anybody wants to reach out to you and all the ways that people can reach you and Dosed to, and you have a book that we never even got to. So I look forward to having you back at some point. I have a feeling you have some more filmmaking in your future.
I do, yeah. And I really want to track this story of the first responders. Like, I just have a heartbeat to be able to help these people who do so much in our culture, and yet nothing has been effective at really helping shift trauma for these first responders. We've got something that can do that now, particularly this model that's really about a collective community. So I'm excited about that.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for coming today and sharing your heart and soul and your work with us.
If you enjoyed today's show and want to help build a more beautiful, conscious, and loving world, please share this content with friends, family, and colleagues. You can follow this show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. And I'd really appreciate you taking the time to write a review so that others can find these amazing conversations. And if you'd like to see a video version of the show, you can find me on YouTube. Feel free to reach out and connect with me at thepsychedelicmom.com or message me on Instagram at thepsychedelicmom. And remember, you are the medicine.